So let's start by going into the session on human flourishing. We'll see what that means as we go along. I'm really talking about, I guess I'm, what we're really looking for is some is a little positive start here, some eudaimonics. And I think we'll start with Anthony Grayling. Anthony Grayling is Professor of Philosophy at Birkbeck College, University of London. He's a columnist in The New Scientist, Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and all sorts of other things, author of a stack of books this high, one of which is called What is Good? What is Good? Anthony Grayling.
Thanks very much indeed. In any enterprise which is even in the remotest bit connected to philosophy, the name of Wittgenstein or Derrida or something like that has to be mentioned, so I've done it now, okay? But the Wittgenstein mention is that one useful thing that philosophy can do is to assemble reminders, as he put it, and so perhaps I'll just kick off by doing that, by trying to situate some connotations of the word flourishing, since we're going to be talking about that this morning, and to give a reason why I think it's a better choice of term to discuss, concept to discuss, than the concept of happiness itself. Because, of course, we're familiar with the recent upsurge of interest in happiness studies. I mean, there are even professors of happiness studies and so on both sides of the Atlantic. And one has to be very careful at the outset in recognizing that the task is not simply to understand what happiness is and what makes for happiness, but also that there is a question about whether happiness is the point. Whether it is the thing that we ought to be talking about, because supposing it were, well, there's a really simple solution to the happiness problem. That is, you just tip Prozac into the public water supply or, you know, ecstasy or something like that, and then everybody's happy. And then even if things decline, just so long as the supply of happiness-producing chemical is constant, they're not going to notice, so, you know, everybody will be happy perpetually. But is that the point? I mean, we're provoked into asking whether that's the point by that question, which would you rather be, a happy pig or an unhappy Socrates, that kind of idea. And the minute that you contemplate that, you begin to think, well, maybe there has to be a much more complicated story about what we mean by happiness, if that's the right term that we should be employing anyway. And in some ways, I don't think it is. I mean, I think that the term used as a translation for Aristotle's eudaimonia is a rather feeble translation of something which, for Aristotle, at any rate, had the idea of well-doing, well-being, of flourishing, something rather rich, experientially rich, which accrues to a person the minute that that person begins to try to live the reasoned and reflective life, given that for Aristotle, as indeed for his teacher Plato, the idea of the considered life, the life examined and chosen and lived according to those choices insofar as possible, actually, to make choices, our neurological friends are going to tell us that, that there's a more complicated story about that, but that kind of life is one which is more likely to be attended by or characterized by eudaimonia than a life which is the result of other people's choices, in which you're a football being kicked around by other people. So to use the term happiness to translate eudaimonia is to miss out on a good deal of texture in the concept that Aristotle had. Now, that's a very, very important thing to remember, which is why I think if we wanted a one-word key notion, flourishing is by far the better one. And it helps us to get started on two trains of thought that have to be connected together at some point. One is this, that if you look at the individual level to ask questions about what flourishing is for a human individual and what makes for it, you're immediately alerted to the fact that the talents that individual people have for living good and flourishing lives, lives that are satisfying to themselves in the living of it, and which are satisfying to themselves because, as of course must be the case, good relationships lie at the very heart of good lives, that those talents for living good lives are as numerous as almost as there are people. There are so many different individual talents for different kinds of good and flourishing lives that to generalize about them is risky. To legislate about what would make for a good life, you know, to get everybody to sign up to a, you know, one-size-fits-all prescription for what makes for a good life is a mistake. And indeed, all the great monolithic ideologies, the religions, Stalinism, everything, all the theses that have it that there is one great truth, Everybody's got to sign up to it, otherwise they're going to be punished if they don't, or coerced into living conformably with that idea. They, all of them, tend to be very productive of unhappiness and rather etiolated lives. It looks as though, therefore, the move from thinking about the individual level where there is this great variety of talents and possibilities for good and flourishing lives, to the general level, there we find that the sorts of things that we can say about the framework within which individuals can choose good and flourishing lives has to be one characterized by a lot of negatives. That's in the sense that what we want to do is to open spaces and limit the degree of coercion that we impose upon people in communities. In order to provide the opportunity for individuals to make the sorts of choices that would result in good lives to themselves, always under the government of a principle, the harm principle, the principle that says, so you know from John Stuart Mill, that whatever you do mustn't limit the freedoms and choices of other people or do them harm. And that is a general principle, a promulgated, so to speak, at the community level, which constrains and governs what individuals do with their choices, but which otherwise allows a large margin for people to make those sorts of choices. So when one thinks about human flourishing and one looks at it from the top-down perspective, that is from the perspective of what structural features of a society would allow people, not coerce them, not make choices for them, but would allow them the space, the margin to make those choices for themselves, one begins to recognize certain familiar themes that have emerged in the West in the modern period. It's a theme about which, by the way, had we well enough time, I could wax on for a very long time, because it seems to me a tremendously interesting story. There's a very interesting little bit of philosophical history here about the way in which conceptions of liberty in particular, starting with the Reformation in the 16th century, where various people were key in demanding liberty of conscience, not just the original reformers themselves, because by one of those wonderful historical accidents, people like Luther and Calvin and others who had sought a liberty of conscience for themselves in breaking away from Roman orthodoxy, very quickly themselves wanted to impose an orthodoxy on others. And so it happened that famously Michael Servetus was prosecuted by Calvin in Geneva for being Unitarian fundamentally. And it was a man called Sebastian Castellio who, having been a friend and an associate of Calvin's, was so horrified by the fact that Calvin could have sought for himself the liberty of conscience and then denied it to somebody else, that he wrote his tract on the liberty of conscience, which was like a match to tinder. And you can see, this is a story powerfully traceable through the modern period, that once the demand for liberty of conscience had been accepted, the demand for liberty of thought more generally, thought and inquiry, became a very potent feature of the intellectual life of Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries, and has a good deal to do with the rise of science in that period. But once people began to think and inquire freely, they began to ask questions about that, why they were owned by a monarch, why they didn't have any say in the running of their own lives. And so the conception of political liberty very quickly came onto the scene. And once that was a question in play, people began to ask, how could it be possible, as Anthony Benezet did in the United States in the middle of the 18th century, that one tranche of human beings owned another tranche of human beings, how slavery could be possible. And once the anti-slavery and anti-slave trade campaigns got going, women who were involved in it and who were licking envelopes and campaigning said to their colleagues, well, you know, this is wonderful that you're fighting to liberate the slaves, but what about the slave in your kitchen, which is Mary Wollstonecraft's question to her men friends. And so the women's movement was given a powerful impetus by it, and so on and so on. You can see all through the history of the workers' movements in the 19th century, the trade union movement, and right up to the considerable reforms that took place in society over a whole range, right up until 1948, the adoption of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that there was an explosion in historical terms. It was a very, very short period, historically speaking, from the Reformation to the 20th century, this idea that the human individual should own himself or herself and make some very fundamental choices about their own lives for themselves. An idea that would have been anathema but before the beginning of the modern period, and which is, along with the splendid, magnificent achievement of science, is, I think, one of the great achievements of modern times in the West. So if you put that kind of perspective behind our thinking about what a social arrangement ought to be to maximize the potential for individuals to live, to seek and to work out the possibility of making good lives for themselves and good chosen relationships, then we see that something like, and I'm not, you know, one doesn't have to fetishize it, but it's just a big straw in the wind in a way, something like the Universal Declaration, which lists, in fact, a number of conditions which have to be satisfied in order for a space to be open for individuals to operate within. I don't think anybody would want to argue that a list of rights, even if they carried with them a list of responsibilities as well, could ever define what a good life would look like. But it would certainly move aside a lot of lumber in the way of people making good lives for themselves. But the idea of individuals seeking and making good lives, of course, invites, in the end, most attention once one has solved the social framework problem about how you open up those spaces for individuals. What sorts of things go into the making of flourishing lives? What are the marks or the characteristics of a life which is felt by the person living it to be good and to be satisfying? I mentioned one in passing there, and that is the very fundamental place of good relationships, and in particular, good chosen relationships, not ones that one is forced to enter into, as was the case when people lived in very, very small village communities, never managed to get out of them, and the lace curtains twitched all the time. That's a kind of an oppression which makes it very difficult for people to have privacy and some of the other materials needed for constructing good lives. And what one needs to do is to identify certain other things that would be characteristic of a good life across the whole range of possible good lives that there might be, given that range of talents. And here, I think, is where we can begin to focus down on some much more specific kinds of inquiry. Because one thing that one needs to do, having taken into account considerations about the human condition, the fact that we are caught in the webs of history, we are born into a particular historical period, into a particular geography, with all the constraints that that implies about our given social relations and political and legal relations and so on. Given all those facts about the human condition, one wants to know facts about the human condition which bear on facts about human nature. And here, I think, is where psychology and neuropsychology can make an enormous contribution to our understanding of what it is to be human, how we respond to certain sorts of things. And why it is, for example, that we all know, because we share this knowledge more than, I think, intuitively, I think to use the word intuition is probably misleading here, why it is that we know of our own children, for example, that they need comfort and they need warmth and they need security and they need to feel loved and they need to be helped to be confident so that they can be actors that can make choices when they're in a position to do so in life. We know all these sorts of things about people and how we would try to help and empower people to take off as autonomous individuals and to build these good lives for themselves. But it would be very interesting to know more about that, more about the psychological architecture of what it is to be a human individual, and an empowered one, one capable of grasping opportunities for flourishing. This is where I think what one could begin to locate things that the empirical sciences could do to help us in thinking about these things. But I end on this note, though, and it's a note, of course, that we all accept and understand, and that is that our understanding of this very complicated and very important topic, the topic of how we identify and encourage flourishing, human flourishing, is not one which is going to be exhausted by what you might call, to just borrow a term from philosophy of mind, a narrow inquiry. That's to say, just on the contents of the cranium or the central nervous system and the endocrine system. But it's going to have something to do with the relationship between the functions instantiated there and the wider social and human environment. And so there is a big research project, a big, rich, interesting research project that really does connect up social circumstances, social environment, moral environment, intellectual environment of an individual, and things that we are increasingly discovering about the functioning of all the hard wiring inside the body. There's going to be, I think, a happy marriage between the neurosciences, neuropsychology on the one hand, and on the other hand, certain of the social sciences, whose target of attention is at the level of relationships, at the level of social structures, and not just neural ones. Thank you very much indeed.